When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ça.
Nice.
Welcome back to part two with the Dean and EJ, the Books Boys.
Woo! Whoa, baby!
So, PJ, I've only got two more books and to review, and if I'm being honest, I'm really only going to talk a lot about one of them. The Scarlet Letter, I'll do it first to get out of the way, didn't inspire a lot of conversation, which might surprise you.
But I thought Alex recommended this to your mutual friend, right?
Yeah, he did, just because it's, you know, it's 1850, it was when it's written. It's taking place in sort of Boston, New England, this type of American, early American sort of society, very Puritan community, super religious, super strict. And he said to me, like, you know, the way he sold it to me was that's during the time of like the Salem witch trials and all that kind of stuff. But that doesn't really come up very much.
Is he a fan of the book?
I'm not sure if he recommended it because of its cultural significance or because he liked it. Like, I'm actually not even so sure if he's read it. I need to talk to him about it.
Okay, fantastic. So tell me.
But I've had it lying around on the shelf for a long time, so I just decided I'll get to it. It's an American classic for the first time.
Yeah, it's a classic. So let's get into American literature. So what did you think of it then?
It was grand.
Like one of the most important books in American literature.
No, it was fine. Like, it's very short. It's only 200 pages. I read it in 2 days.
So that's very disappointing. So you would have liked it more if it had done Anna Karenina. It's 1,000.
Maybe. It's written in, you know, there's a lot of thou arts and a lot of sort of old Middle English type.
I thought you would like that stuff.
Yeah, it's fine. I just okay. So in terms of does the witch type stuff come in? Well, there's a character they refer to as an old witch lady, and she's talking about some kind of thing in the guy in the forest and whatever. But that's just mentioned a couple of times. Like, it never comes to anything. We never find out anything about witches or
disappointing.
You know, yeah. It's like you're there's the idea that stuff might be going on in the background, but that's it. It's not really relevant, you know. So I'm going to do this one in 3 minutes if I can. It can be really dealt with very, very. In a very straightforward manner. We have a girl, she's come over from England. Her husband's supposed to be coming behind her. 2 years later, he hasn't shown up.
Oh, Lord.
She sleeps with another person, a preacher. And even though her husband is not there for 2 years and possibly dead, like there's been no word from him. He could have been shipwrecked on the way over, whatever it is. This super strict, you know, Christian Puritan society brand her, you know, as a kind of harlot. And so she takes all this moral culpability and shame. She refuses to ever say who the guy was. Okay. So the preacher has guilt on his hands, but he's safe, whereas she has to stand in the pillory and be kind of abused by the town for a couple of hours. And then for the rest of her life, wear this scarlet letter A embroidered with gold thread onto her dress.
All right.
She has to go around with this mark of shame for the rest of her life.
Interesting. I had no idea that's what the scarlet letter.
Yeah, nor did I. It's actually a letter someone written.
Yeah, I thought it was a letter. Yeah.
So it's a letter embroidered on her, and she has a little baby.
What do you mean? People, hold on a second. From the preacher, or from her?
From the preacher. Right. And people joke about the baby that she's called Hester. They joke about the baby that it's a kind of half demon or a half witch, but I don't think anyone really takes it seriously. Like, they say that almost in half jest. The town actually want to look after the baby, you know. They're not trying to kill it or anything strange like that.
To be honest, it sounds really good though.
So that's the premise, but that all takes place quite quickly, and then nothing really happens for the rest of the book. That's the problem. The premise is fantastic. But basically, she's shunned by society, and she slowly wins them over like a 7-year period by just like being humble, putting up with any humiliation and abuse the town give her, you know, and eventually kind of wins them over, I guess. Her little daughter Pearl, you know, the joke that she's a kind of witch child or a fairy or something, because half elf, mm-hmm. because she's very high spirited and runs around, and she's a child, right? That's what children do. Mm-hmm. The town want to take the child off her at one point because they want to make sure the child is well raised, not by an immoral woman. But she resists, and they accept it. And to be honest, it's all fine. There is this idea that, you know, the priest is the preacher, the pastor, whatever he is a bit of a coward. You know, he's letting her take all the shame, and he's not taking any. And he kind of says, "One day I'll be able to hold your hand in public. But for now, let's sneak away to the forest and do it." You know. And
what, so they're still making love?
Well, no, but they're just like meeting up and displaying affection for each other. Not initially, but it grows back again throughout the course of the book.
Okay.
But there is a villain, old Roger Chillingworth. There's this old, really mean, old, evil man going around the town. And it turns out, slight spoiler, he's the husband.
No, hold on a second.
This is important. Because the book needs a villain. He's the husband who was meant to have followed her over in the beginning.
Oh.
But he's been there all along, and for some reason, he just disregards her and doesn't want anyone to know that he's her husband. So the main premise of this novel is, if you reveal my secret, that I'm your husband, then I'll reveal the secret that it was the preacher who is the father of your baby.
Right.
So that's where the tension of the entire novel comes from.
Okay.
So they go on for 7 years in this limbo of her just putting up with like humiliation daily.
Honestly, it sounds awesome. But yeah, okay, you still didn't like it. I mean, the premise does sound great.
I will say I did like it. I just feel like maybe more needed to happen, or just kind of, there was times where I was skimming through it because there was entire chapters where nothing was really happening and they're just kind of preaching at me, you know?
Okay.
But, you know, the most salient point to take away from this book, and you get this in a lot of the Victorian literature as well, it's these kind of Christian lady societies. You get them in the Dickens books and things, but it's this idea of like, and I find the Puritans essentially evil in this book, but they're using religion to mask their own moral culpability. You know, like they're treating this poor girl who, as far as I can see, has really done nothing wrong. And they're treating her horribly under the guise of, well, we're like super strict religious, you know? And I think that really the social commentary is on religion, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. But I was disappointed that there was not really much witch stuff. But yeah, like the Puritans want to have this holier than thou kind of self-righteousness. And all they're really doing is using it as a cloak to go around and be mean to other people. So yeah, that's really all I have to say about The Scarlet Letter. I don't want to spoil the ending, and it's a short book, so there's not a huge amount to go through. The premise is fantastic, and the book is...
Yeah.
Decent. You know, maybe if a bit more had happened in the second half, that's all.
I've got to say, though, Dean, that this month's the premise from all the books so far really found very intriguing. So,
yeah,
actually, you're doing a good job. I mean, yeah, it's not that obviously I just have a problem with all this Victorian philosophy at the time, but the stories themselves are very intriguing, especially the last one.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. And we've only got one more book to go. And then we're going to be out of here. Hold on. See? The phone ringing, I think. Bear with me. I'll be back in a few minutes. I'll see who's
calling. Okay.
Hello, you're through to Books Boys. You've got Dean on the line. Who's calling?
It's John Constable.
John, wow. Well, it's nice of you to call in. And I'm assuming that you're the John Constable who wrote this lovely book that I have in front of me, The Chanteuse from Cape Town.
The Chanteuse from Cape Town, yes, indeed. It's my debut novel, and it was released into the world about 2 months ago now, mid-January.
Yeah, so I got this one more or less, you know, as soon as it was out, and we talked about it last month, so it's very fortuitous of you to call in and have a chat with us about it. I mean, first off, I loved it, and if you heard that our episode, you'll know that I really, really had a high opinion of it. You've been writing for a long time, is that right?
Yes, but on and off. I have been at this for many decades, but there have been long gaps in between my writing stints because I was doing other things. But it's something that I've come back to in recent years, and I'm trying to make more of an effort now to craft something which constitutes a series. And this expedition with Sol Nemo and South Africa is the way I'm planning to go, certainly for the forthcoming period. There is a second book which is completed, and I'm working on a third at the moment. I'm trying to put some impetus behind it.
Wow. Okay. So that's, you know, something I usually ask at some point is, when's the next book going to be written? But you've done it. You've written it.
Yes, and I'm hoping to launch, I think, perhaps late summer, maybe September, October time. There is obviously some work to be done in terms of publishing and book cover design and all that sort of stuff.
Those bits and pieces,
But that's the plan at the moment,
Okay, and you've already got ideas for a third, which is fantastic. Now, at the moment, we've got the one book, and then there's a short story that you can read on your website. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. I don't know whether you've looked at the short story. Not many people seem to actually find it, but that's there, and it's about 5,000 words, so it's it's a 15-20 read.
Mm-hmm. No, that's, it's interesting to get that little extra little bit just to give us a little bit more of Sol. I like Sol. He's your kind of, I mean, how would we describe the guy? Because he's got his links with SAPS, the kind of police force there, but he also isn't trusting of them, and he's a bit of a renegade. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And obviously, on the back of this massive inheritance which he received and wasn't certainly in any way expected, he does have a certain freedom of manoeuvre which might be denied to other people whose circumstances are more straitened.
Yeah, he gets around okay. He's got his nice car and everything, which eventually gets blown up. But, he has a nice heart as well, though. I mentioned it last month, but there's the moment where, you know, when he's going around talking to people and trying to find out information, and he comes across the one girl who's been really mistreated by her husband, but, you know, he's rich and she can't afford the lawyer. So he says, well, here's my overpriced kind of watch. Go and pawn it and, get yourself a lawyer. So he has a heart.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's all part, I think, of trying to create a character. So I try to be conscious of these things, just introduce some subtlety and some nuances, hopefully, which will strike a resonance and get people to like the character and hopefully like the writing and the plots which I'm trying to create.
Mm-hmm. The plot's brilliant. I mean, I love that we deal with the character first, you know, and obviously there's stuff happening. We've got the stuff with Frank and Mira and everything, but then we by the end, it's a full-on action movie type scene when they get up to Swartman's vineyard and everything. So it gets very dramatic.
That's been commented upon by other people. But certainly at the time that I was writing it, I wasn't particularly conscious in that sort of way. But I mean, there is quite an explosion, I think, towards the end of the book.
There is, although I think it's apt. You know, it builds up to it. It doesn't come out of nowhere. It fits and everything. It's perfect. Let me ask you, who do you see as being the real villain of the book? Is it Dutoit or is it Swartman?
Well, I think both of them. As one of my reviewers said, Dutoit is unlovely. Swartman, well, I mean, he's a drug dealer of long standing. So, you know, they form a conspiracy between the two of them. And they're both pretty unappealing characters.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Swartman's more your, as you say, kind of career criminal type, more into the violence. I mean, they rough up Sol pretty bad. Whereas Dutoit, I suppose, is more the fancier type of criminal. You know, he's got his official kind of business. He's doing his financial advising to Frank, and you know whatever he's doing for him, and he's kind of making everything seem a nice little sheer veneer of officialness to it all. But then under the surface, he's actually just working with Swartman. You know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's very much a criminal enterprise, but obviously they approach it from different motivational standpoints. Mm. Yeah.
I want to ask you one question. Was there a deliberate decision not to give us too much of Frank? Because, you know, reading the early parts, I'm thinking, okay, Saul's got this big, you know, bond to Frank. Hopefully we'll get to know a lot about this guy. And then we don't really see much of him, and then he's dead.
Yeah. I think this was just the way that the thing evolved as I was writing it. And, you know, one of the aspects which I think I was keen to explore as far as Sol's character was concerned is this personal battle that he's got with mental health. And obviously that comes into very sharp focus at the point where, you know, sadly he loses this surrogate father figure.
Yeah, and Frank, and that's something important to mention. Frank was a kind of father figure to him, and yeah, I suppose he was important in his life. So that's what I mean. That's the whole reason that's Saul's entire motivation here, isn't it? It's to protect, you know, Frank. Obviously, he thinks he's been swindled out of this money. Yeah. He's a bit suspicious of Mira as well, and he's doing it. You know, there's nothing tying him to this. He hasn't been paid to do this investigative work as such.
No, that's right. That's right. But his motivation, I think, going forward, because he has the benefit of this very large inheritance, is that he's in a position to be able to, you know, perhaps give something back and to work for people typically who wouldn't be able to afford his services. So, again, that is part of the character. I mean, he works for free. He's not there running a business in the way that he would have to if he didn't have other means, independent means.
Which I suppose is admirable. And as I say, he's a likable, despite being a bit of a tough guy almost and a bit of a renegade, he's also, as we said before, he's likable. So that just plays further into that.
I mean, certainly a central character of that sort, I think, has to be likable. It's debatable, I suppose. Maybe he wouldn't be, but I mean, I would rather read books that where you relate to the character in some positive sense rather than thinking, well, actually, you know, this person is a really bad lot and I'm going to have to plow through the rest of the book. So that was my take on it. But I mean, like us all, you know, there are parts which are good and there are parts which are bad. And there are bits in between where we might have some, you know, long discussion.
So I want to ask a little bit about the sequel then. I mean, I'm not asking for any spoilers as such, but are we going to see more of Aisha?
No, we're not, actually. she's a bit of a figure of mystery, isn't she?
I want more of her.
The second book is called The Truth about Anton van Zyl. It is profiled briefly on my website, which you can visit at johnconstableauthor.com, and there's some information about me, but there is also a synopsis with regard to the second book. But no, sadly, she does not feature in the second book, and as far as I can see at the moment, she doesn't feature in the third either. So I mean, maybe when I get round to writing the fourth, perhaps she can be brought back in.
Okay, so maybe in the future, but we're done with her for now.
Yeah,
she is interesting because I couldn't figure her out, you know, and I wanted I'm a sucker for a romance plot, right? I want the nice relationship with Saul and Aisha to work out, but at the same time, we don't know. He doesn't even know much about her, never mind us.
Yeah, well, it's the fact that, you know, his base is Port Elizabeth in South Africa, and she seems to spend an awful lot of time away in Johannesburg and Pretoria. And she is apparently working for this French perfumery company. And yeah, he doesn't know too much about her. So this is a very sort of off-on relationship. And of course, on the back of the fact that he's inherited all this money, and because of his insecurities, you know, he's sort of questioning why she would suddenly be starting to make some more positive play for him than has been the case in the past. So again, it's left as an open question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the last character, I suppose, that I think merits some discussion is, of course, the chanteuse herself. It's Mira.
Yeah.
I think she's a fantastic character, and you know, tragedy ensues and all the rest of it. But what was the inspiration? So I understand the inspiration for this, the whole setting, is obviously your own visits, you know, in South Africa and spending time there yourself. What was the inspiration for the chanteuse, for Mira?
Well, I was looking, obviously, to derive a plot. And as I think these things often happen, or they do as far as I'm concerned, it's a process of building, and it doesn't go together necessarily very quickly, certainly in my case. And you put bits and pieces together. Hopefully you've got some idea of where you're starting from, and you've got hopefully some idea as to where you might end up. And then there's this big piece in the middle, which is not really fixed, and you sit down and start writing. And things go off in different directions. And the plots evolved. That's, I think, the best way that I can describe it. I mean, I spent, I think, probably about 18 months off and on actually writing it. And it's a process of evolution. Writers work in different ways, as you know. I mean, some start simply with a blank page and off they go, and others will sit down and map everything out to the last detail. I think I'm probably in the first category. But always what you're trying to do, I think, is to put together something which is credible, you know, that you've got a plot which actually does hang together, and people aren't left thinking, oh, gosh, no, that's another coincidence, which, you know, I didn't expect or anticipate. So that's part of the difficulty, is just, you know, getting everything to align. So, yeah, it is a process. It's a process. I have sleepless nights thinking about aspects of plot and, you know, what I might be doing going forward.
I mean, that's, every writer has their process, as you say. One thing I always find interesting was two authors that I find very similar are P.G. Wodehouse and Agatha Christie, because they both churn out those little 180-page little short books, you know, one with murders, one with jokes, you know.
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually, because it's a long time since I've read any P.G. Wodehouse. But on this trip, this last trip down to South Africa, I thought I would reacquaint myself. So I bought a volume of collected short stories, I think, called Carry On Jeeves. These were written, they were written, a number of them, over 100 years ago. And I worked my way through that. And that was quite amusing.
What I find very interesting, just on the note of the process, is despite Agatha Christie and P.G. Wodehouse turning out what are comparable books, Agatha Christie would just write it with no real idea what she was doing, and just you know, let it write itself. Whereas Wodehouse would write about 1,000 pages and then edit it down to 200. You know, so it's interesting that you can have such a wildly different process for a similar result.
Yeah. And of course, the other interesting thing, I mean, I don't know when you were aware of this, but P.G. Wodehouse and Raymond Chandler were both educated at Dulwich College. Not in the same years, but again, there's some similarities, I think, in terms of style and approach. It's a fascinating subject, but yeah, at the end of the day, different writers work in different ways, and
that's it. Well, normally when I do these interviews, people tell me, "Oh, the next book's not going to be out for a year, 2 years," and I'm thinking, oh, my goodness. But you've actually said the second book is written, so I'm hoping it's out sooner rather than later, and I'm looking forward to reading it. I'll put a link to your website in the show notes, so that people can go and have a look at it. And obviously they can get the book. What I'd like to ask you is our final question that I ask to everyone. If there's any existing book that you wish you'd been the person to write, what would it be?
If I had to choose one, I think it would probably be John Buchan's The 39 Steps.
Ah, good choice.
Which is a novella. It's not a long book. I'm not quite sure how many words it is, but you can read it from start to finish in a couple of hours. And it does creak a bit, I think, and some of the attitudes struck and so on we would regard now as being xenophobic and rather dated. But it's a wonderful story, I believe, and it's something that I quite frequently reread. And the descriptions, some of the descriptions of the lowlands of Scotland, I think are brilliant. So yeah, if I had to choose one at the end of the day, if you were putting me on the spot, that would be it, I think.
It's a good choice. I've actually not read it, but I've seen it performed in theater, and the story is fantastic.
You must do because you can pick. I don't think it was published originally in 1915. I don't think it's ever actually been out of print. You can pick up a copy very cheaply and you can read it in a couple of hours, but I think it's great. I really do.
I'll have to get a hold of it next time I go to the bookshop. Well, John, thank you so much for calling in. Thanks for your time. Thanks. We love the book. And enjoy the rest of your day. Take care.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for the opportunity. And just to reiterate, the title of the book is The Chanteurs from Cape Town. I hope people buy it and read it and, more importantly, enjoy it.
That's it. We recommend it. I'll put the full title, link to your website and everything in the show notes. And there'll be some pictures of me reading it on our Instagram. So everyone will see the lovely cover and the full title. John, take care. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Well, there we go. Thank you to John Constable for giving us a call. We chatted about his book, The Chanteuse from Cape Town, in a bit more detail on last month's episode. And it's always nice to hear from authors. Guys, if you ever want to call into the show, you can definitely do that. If you want to send us your books or you need a mailing address, get in touch, booksboys@hotmail.com, and we would love hear from anyone. You can even send us little voicemails or recommendations, whatever you want. We'll play those on the show. We've done that before.
Yeah, thanks very much, guys. And thanks very much, John, for calling in and sending us our book.
Now, what I like is that this episode is going to be about 2 hours long. Well, probably not an hour and a half. PJ's still doing his laundry.
I'm still doing my laundry. I'm just finishing up. I'm going to show Dean. If you want to see more, just money. You can see. This could be a great sideshow, right? If you pay more, you can see us doing the show and me doing the laundry at the same time.
Yeah.
So nothing else happening. I'm not wearing any provocative lingerie. I'm just wearing my just kind of pajamas, to be honest, today, and doing the laundry. It's quite an impressive part I've got here. I've got to tell you. Dean, I'm going to show you. I'll show you. Are you ready?
Let's have it.
Okay, here it is. Look at that. That's an impressive pot.
Neat piles of laundry, all nicely
neat
folded.
Piles of laundry on a huge table. So I think it's very relaxing. My God, I never would have thought so relaxing to just have a chat, do a bit of laundry.
Yeah, there we go. So now every time you need to do the laundry, we just do some kind of improvised episode about something,
Indeed. And any time you, dear listener, want to do the laundry, why don't you listen to a sensual episode of Books Boys?
There we go. But before we get too sensual, I'll move on real quick.
Okay.
And also, as I mentioned, emailing us, but don't forget, we've got things like Instagram and everything as well at Books Boys Podcast. I haven't been posting much anymore. Just I think social media is not really a great thing in general.
What about the whole water bottle not water bottle, the whole bottle message we're talking about? Is that not in anymore? Like messages through
send us a message in a bottle, smoke signals, carrier pigeons. We love to get your books in those
your novel in the method.
So the last book was Carlos Ruiz Zafón.
We're talking about the big guy.
Medianoche. So the midnight
we're talking
palace.
About the big guy.
Nice picture of a train on fire. Oh, you can't see it. My camera's knocked off.
No, turn it
there you
off,
go. Man. Nice picture of a train on fire there on the
And that is I read the first part of that trilogy, right? I'm not sure what the name of the trilogy is now, but it's a series of...
you read The Prince of Mist?
I read The Prince of Mist. Wow, what a great book. What a great book, I'm telling you. Beautifully, concisely, what I was just saying, concisely written story set in the Second World War, but outside the Second World War. It's kind of like always in the background.
So I have a surprise for you. It's actually, I don't believe, a trilogy. His man books that we covered before are a series, but his young adult books that he wrote first, I thought they were also a series. It turns out they're just unrelated books.
It's just they're often published together, I've noticed here in Spain.
Because this one is set in 1932 Calcutta in India.
Right. Nice. Okay. And has it got like a love that font? So guys, if you haven't read The Shadow, The Shadow of the Wind, Sombra del Viento, and the whole kind of sequence of novels that came, we made a whole episode of one of my favorite episodes, just about Safon. And my God, he's such a great author, isn't he?
Yeah, he is fantastic. And we did talk about interviewing his ghost at one point, but we never got around to that.
We did, yeah. Well, that comes because I literally thought at the time he was still alive, and immediately he passed on. Yeah. And then I also thought we might have the chance to talk with him, but it was probably not the case, even if you
have him. Well, yeah, anyway. He's very famous. But...
What do you think of this book? So I love the Príncipe de la Niebla. It was his first book. And this is his second book. This is the second book he wrote.
The second book. It's only about 300 pages, a lot shorter than some of the ones we covered before. I was expecting something really simplistic compared to the other books because I thought these are the young adult ones, but there's not much of a drop, you know. I thought this is going to be like almost for children or something compared to the Cemetery of Lost Books. It's slightly more basic, but really not a big drop in level of language or anything like that.
Mm.
So, what is the story? We have a chap called Jawahal, who is our villain. So we kind of meet him first. We find out that he's a villain, basically, and that's like the intro part of the novel. We don't like this guy. Then we have a Mr. Carter, who's the head of this place that essentially we have children, I guess orphans essentially, like growing up in this place until they hit 16. Okay. And a lady comes to him, an Aryani, and she sort of says, she's inquiring about a particular boy that might be there. And then our villain, Jawahal, also goes to him to inquire about a boy who might be there. And this is a boy called Ben. Mm. And this boy is just finishing up his time there. He's coming up to his 16th birthday. And he's a member of a group of friends called the Chobar Society, who are all, I think, about to finish up their time. And the society is disbanding. Okay. This lady has a girl with her called Shear. Possibly Shire, I'm not sure. But it turns out that Shire is actually Ben's twin sister. And then we've got a bit of, family stories going on. My one criticism of the book is a lot of the story is told by the granny just giving exposition. There's just like here's a massive exposition dump. I'm going to tell the entire story in like this long narrated chapter. And I really felt that wasn't a good way to do it, you know?
Right.
That's my only real criticism. But I want to still enjoy the book. I'm not going to let that take away from it. It's just maybe a strange way to do it. It turns out this guy, Jawahal, I mean, the book gets a bit magical, right? Which sometimes loses me a little bit. But he somehow has engulfed the soul of their father. And now he needs to replenish it. And now that they're kind of coming of age, he wants to take Ben and take his soul to keep his own spirit living, essentially. It kidnaps all the friends and everything, so that's where it ends up. But I'm not going to go into the ending. But they meet in this old abandoned house, which they call the Midnight Palace. And then it turns out that this is the house that their dad had built for them. And there's some clues that they follow, and they follow these clues. And then they get to like this old train station that has this train and that Jawahal is on. And then it's a fire and everything. And that's the cover that we just talked about. It's kind of a lot happening, but it gets a little bit weird when it starts to get mystical, and with the spirits and things like that. It sort of loses me a little bit. I do prefer things that are really realistic based on reality, or, you know, maybe a Dickens-style caricature of reality, but fantasy loses me a little bit. But I think this was well done. And, I mean, again, I don't have a massive amount to talk about. there's good, there's drama with the family, with them discovering that they're twins, with, you know, the fact that Jawahal kind of has the spirit of his dad or whatever, or the body of his dad. Then there's the, you know, explosions and fire and all this kind of drama. There's the big set piece at the end where Ben has to choose whether his friends I'm not going to say what happens, but I just want to that there is a big dramatic kind of piece.
Well, yeah, it's a fun after all. Yeah.
It's just unfortunate that there's a big exposition dump in it that kind of gives you the whole story in one go.
Right, you know? Okay.
So it's like, well, what are we waiting for now?
I suppose he's still experimenting around as a novelist. I mean, The Shadow of the Wind is either his fourth or his fifth novel. I'm not sure right now. So, I mean, yeah, it takes a while to get that kind of practice, I suppose. Mm.
And I made that sound fast, but, you know, a lot of the novel is spent up with people trying to say, this guy is coming after us, trying to convince Mr. Carter, please look through your records, you know, this guy Jawahal is coming after us, well, can you help us, you know? And then they go to this hospital where he was supposed to have been until it had burnt down. And then they say, well, actually, we can't find a record of this guy. And they say, well, sure, he would be dead anyway. And they say, what do you mean he would be dead? And they say, well, it burned down in like 1857. And they say, no, but he told us it burned down in 1916. And they can't find a record of that incident. So things get a little bit more wishy-washy and a bit more mysterious. But I sometimes feel like not everything is cleared up. Although you could argue that that's the case with Zafon anyway. You know, when we read the second book before, it gets a bit confusing near the end, and not all the mystery is ever really cleared up, other than they mention later that the guy was going a bit crazy. You know? So maybe that is just a trope of his. But I liked this. I just didn't... When I read La Sombra del Viento, I needed more. When I read El Juego del Ángel, I needed more. When I read this, I kind of thought, okay, that was fine.
Right.
Okay. You know, I'm not about to rush out and buy The Prince of Mist now, or Marina, or whatever the other one is. You know, I just don't I don't feel that this was as strong, but it's earlier work and it's more basic work. So I suppose that's to be expected.
Okay. Fair enough. But are you still going? Do you think you still might read more just because you still love Safan? You still love Safan, you know what I mean? Or do you think you really don't want to give?
I would say that if I'm in a bookshop and I see a copy of them at a decent price, I might pick one up. But I'm not going to rush out and get them, you know?
The first Safan book I read was The Prince of Mist, Príncipe de la Niebla. And I bought it with you. You were there in the Magic Bookshop in Belfast in Spanish. Do you remember?
I got a hard copy. I don't. They very rarely have Spanish books in there.
That was a good long time ago now. I think that was back in 2014. Wow. So we were in Magic Bookshop and I got it there. So that was my first Safan book. I loved Príncipe de Niebla and I had a really lovely hardback edition as well, which I got in the Magic Bookshop. So I recommend that one. I don't know what his other young adult books are like.
I actually went to the Magic Bookshop recently and I purchased Agatha Christie. And I thought, I'll read this and we'll do a Caber Captains. And of course, it turned out that I'd already got it and I'd already read it.
Oh,
so I've now got a duplicate copy. So.
Wait a minute, you can never have enough of Agatha Christie.
You can never tell if you've read them because they all sound the same based on just the blurbs.
Well, it's great that we're, you know, we're sponsoring this Magic Bookshop, yet it's not the name of the bookshop, is it? I actually don't remember the name of the bookshop right now.
Keats and Chapman, but I prefer to forget that. I've already called the Magic
Bookshop. Okay. But it is run by a magician. He speaks usually Irish when I go inside.
Oh, okay. I've never had that, but I have had them playing some trumpet for me while I've been there.
Well, it's lovely. Look, it's in Belfast City Centre, pretty central as well. So just do have a look out for that bookshop as well. What's it called again, Dave?
Chapman. And you wrote a poem about it, and I did a painting about it, which we covered in an episode of Poetry Pals on our Patreon.
And we made some promotional photos outside of it, just very spontaneously with our neutral friend, Alex.
I think even on Booksboy.
Does he even know about us? I hope he's aware that we're promoting the book.
I think I told him. I sent him the painting and the poem, I think.
Oh, did you? That's sweet. Okay.
He just said, yeah, that's nice. Yeah.
Did some magic tricks. Play the trumpet. Yeah. Maybe he can maybe compose a trumpet song for us in Irish. I love that.
That would be cool. Yeah. Well, I don't have anything more to say about the book, really, other than that it was good. You know, Zafon's always good. It was just early work. I think that's us at an end, dear PJ.
There we go. So I really enjoyed Doing the Laundry again. Highly recommend that. I definitely want to read more some conscious children books. If anyone is out there want to send us some, that's what I'm interested at the moment. Oh. But I wish you all a great reading month and a great reading April when you're listening to this. But by this time when you're listening, Dean will already have gone to Athens. But now, first of all, I just want to wish you a great trip, you and our mutual friend.
Thank you very much. There will be more trips this year. In fact, when you listen to the end of May episode, you will hopefully hear about my visit to Gran Canaria. So that'll be
an
interesting trip. Hopefully we get some more promotional photos.
Exciting stuff ahead.
Guys, that's the end. I was thinking about what to close this episode with. And I thought, you know, why don't we do something slightly different? We once made, I don't know when, maybe in around 2015 or so, a little short instrumental on the keyboard together, mostly you, to be honest. It's called Dancing in a Cuban Cafe. And I thought we'd close with that.
Let's do it.
So if the DJ would spin that record, we'll be back in about a month.
See ya.
Books Boys was presented by The Dean and PJ Burke in association with Thaddeus Penguin Productions. Ha! This episode was brought to you by our sponsor, Pawning Diamonds for My Husband. If you would like to get in touch, you can email us at booksboys@hotmail.com or visit us at booksboys.com. The intro uses Driving in the 70s from the Of Soundtracks and Garage Bands EP by Trapdoor. And the outro uses Dog's Light by Bravo Max from the album of the same name. All music used is either Podsafe or used with permission. If you'd like to support the show, go to patreon.com/booksboys, get the show early and all of our bonus Boof Fan the Boys shows. And you can also check out our music on Spotify or Apple Music. Thank you kindly for listening to us. Please tell your friends. And come back next time for another episode of books, boys. Read some books! Okay, I need to edit that out. That is not what I meant to play.
I was just saying that you just played that.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.